Welcome to the Parliamentary Podcast Series, Partnering for Global Impact, presented by the Parliamentary Network on the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. The podcast is brought to you in partnership with the Parliamentary Engagement Teams of the World Bank and IMF. Join us as we engage in discussions with leading development experts and parliamentarians from around the world. Together, we'll explore how we can take decisive action to achieve a world free of poverty on a livable planet. Now, let's jump right into today's episode, which comes directly from the 2025 Global Parliamentary Forum.
Good morning and welcome to this first second session of our second day of the forum. And it is on a major issue for global economic growth. The title of this session is Catalyzing Private Capital to Foster Growth and Job Creations. So before we get started, just a little reminder about what was said yesterday evening. There are a few changes in our program this morning because we have the honor to welcome at 10:30 the General Manager of IFC, Mr. Mokhtar Diop, who will be joining us. And we'll have to adjust the schedule a little bit so we can make the most out of his time with us, to hear from him and also to have a conversation with him. This first panel will last around 20-25 minutes, and it will be followed by a session of Q&A for about 25 minutes. So now it's time to dive in and introduce our speakers. So we first will listen to Mr. Ranjit Singh, who is Deputy Director of the Monetary and Capital Markets Department at the IMF. He has an extensive experience in promoting global financial stability and supporting reforms that foster investment in emerging economies. Then we will listen to Norman Loaiza, Director of the Global Indicators Group at the World Bank Group, specialist in governments and investment climate indicators. And then we will listen to Mr. Tony Lofreda, Senator from Canada. Tony chairs the Canadian chapter of the Parliamentary Network on the World Bank and the IMF. He has a 35 years experience in the financial sector, and he is considered a rainmaker with a conscience. I read this about you, Tony. So then we will listen to Honorable Giulio Centemero, who is a member of the Italian Parliament and who has recently been elected president of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Mediterranean. Congratulations, Giulio. And Italy now assumes the presidency following Morocco. I'm delighted to moderate this discussion, and I will immediately give the floor to our first speaker, Mr. Ranjit Singh, to ask him, what priorities would you recommend to policymakers and to members of parliament to create a financially attractive environment for private investors? The floor is yours for 10 minutes. Thank you.
Good morning. It's a great privilege to be here. Thank you very much, Senator Tazi, for the opening and kind welcome, and members of the esteemed panel. It's a great privilege to be able to share the floor with you this morning. I had the privilege of also listening in to the session yesterday with Managing Director Kristalina and World Bank President Ajay Banga speaking there, and they had provided, you know, obviously a fantastic context to our discussions today. It's particularly pleasing to be able to speak with you as a given my background as a former policymaker in emerging markets. I'm well aware of how financial markets and financial strains in financial markets and trends can sometimes impact national financial systems, and how important it is to have engagements such as this. My remarks this morning, in true IMF fashion, will focus more on the vulnerabilities and risks. I come from the Monetary and Capital Markets Department of the Fund, and we produce the Global Financial Stability Report. I was the former chief of markets at the MCM, which produced these reports. And I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the areas, particularly in the non-banking space, where we see some of these issues and vulnerabilities. And I'm sure my colleague from the World Bank, Norman, will cover a lot of the development aspects of financial markets. Ladies and gentlemen, as you're well aware, over the last past decade or so, maybe a little bit more, international financial reforms that have been introduced following the global financial crisis have really strengthened the resilience of the overall financial system. Stronger supervision, regulations, much more improvements in crisis management, and a more macro-prudential approach to financial sector oversight have really enabled financial institutions to weather some of the shocks that we've seen happen over the last few years. However, clearly, policymaking is not static. As the financial landscape evolves, I think the biggest challenge we all face as policymakers, you as legislators, is how do you keep pace with the changing landscape and ensure that the financial system remains resilient. Clearly, the financial system, the global financial system, is undergoing a fundamental transformation. And one of the key components of this transformation is the role that's being played by non-bank financial intermediation. This shift is altering not just the risk dynamics, but the very plumbing of financial markets. And the way that traditional regulation had not really been designed to address. You've seen episodes of market turbulence in the recent years where a common thread of influence or impact has really been the influence of non-bank financial institutions. And I will sometimes use the moniker NBFIs. As a former chair of an market regulator, I prefer not to use that, but that is a general term that's being used around the world, non-bank financial intermediation. It used to be some people refer to them as shadow banking, which was even worse because it sort of has a connotation that something operates in the shadow. But these are actually very, very important players in financial markets, but there are pockets of risks which we need to be able to pay attention to. So regardless of how we classify this group of NBFIs, whether you know it's investment funds, they're all part of it, sovereign funds, hedge funds, pension schemes, insurance companies, and now emerging digital financial firms, they have expanded rapidly. Estimates suggest that roughly 13% of the global financial system, or somewhere in the order of 50 trillion, are made up of these non-bank financial institutions. Now, clearly, this is a very, very important segment, and they provide great benefits. And many, many of us who have worked in emerging markets have consciously worked towards ensuring that the capital markets component grows much stronger. In fact, most of the financial systems in both advanced and emerging markets still remain very banking-centric. But clearly, the development of capital markets, non-bank financial intermediation, provides some real positive benefits, both in terms of the growth of market-based financing and enabling capital formation, as well as providing greater risk diversification and really reducing the over-reliance on traditional banks. Yet, it introduces pockets of risks. Our work at the IMF, as I said, particularly in the context of our global financial stability reports and related publications, and I will pick on the work that's been done over the last 12 months, have shown some of the emerging risks in the non-banking space. I'll focus on three areas very briefly: private credit markets, pension funds, and the digital technology, and discuss some of the implications for policymakers and legislators such as yourself. Private credit has grown fivefold over the past decade to about 2.1 trillion globally. This reflects the broader trend of credit moving away from traditional banks and public markets to less regulated, more opaque private credit markets. Now, while private credit serves as a vital tool for diversifying business funding, its growth has created blind spots for regulators. Policymakers must pay close attention to this expanding market, as private credit markets are generally opaque, lightly regulated, and really have been untested at scale in terms of how they endure a significant downturn given this current size. So there are several risk areas that our report published last year highlighted, including vulnerability of borrowers, given that private credit often finances companies that are highly leveraged, operate carrying floating rate debt, and have very little access to alternative finance, and therefore in a higher for longer interest rate environment, the combination can have repercussions. There's also liquidity risk. Private credit is typically structured for long-term investments, but we are now seeing a rise in semi-liquid products as well as some retail participation. And this creates potential for redemption runs. There's also valuation opacity. Private credits don't have public markets to price, and therefore they're not marked to markets, but they're marked to model. And therefore, the valuation frameworks are often not so clear. And there is a systemic interconnectedness between private credits and private equity sponsors, pension funds, and insurance companies. And this is a theme that I will repeat and which I think is very common, which is the interconnectedness that this component of the financial system creates. So the role really for policymakers is to take an approach which covers three areas. First of all, closing the data gaps is critical because understanding the risks involved require these data gaps to be addressed. We need to have a consistent view of who holds the risk, how much leverage is embedded in the system, and how these exposures are distributed across jurisdictions and sectors. Secondly, aligning regulation with risk is essential. And this, again, is a theme that we have often emphasized. Same activity, same risk, same regulation. It is important that whether the credit provided by a bank, an asset manager, or an insurance company, the regulatory framework should be reflective of the risks that involve. And finally, enhancing supervision becomes necessary. Another area that we have looked at is the that we've actually just recently published in last month is a financial stability note on the growing role of pension funds and their financial stability implications. Traditionally, pension funds have been viewed as long-term stable investors, but they have expanded both in size and influence, and now again accounting for substantial portions of the global financial system and increasingly in financial sector assessment programs, FSAPs, that we do. The pension funds component is part of the term or scope of work, given its impact on financial stability. So this growth, again, has created challenges in terms of the determining the channels of interconnectedness with the broader financial system, raising concerns that these vulnerabilities may, in fact, pose financial stability risks. And whilst pension funds used to invest in traditional asset classes, what we've seen is over the past decade, many of them now have turned to complex financial instruments like derivatives or private assets. And whilst these shifts provide greater returns, they also make them much more susceptible to short-term volatility and liquidity risk despite their long-term investment horizons. And
sorry, I had to ask for scope.
All right, we'll conclude. Yeah. Let me conclude then very quickly in the last section. The other area which I wanted to touch on very briefly was on digital technologies. And I think in the area of digital technologies, you've heard on the AI presentations, I will not go to that in the interest of time, but I would recommend, if you have the opportunity, to take a look at the Global Financial Stability Report that was published last year. Let me then move on to my concluding points, Senator Tazi, very briefly. I think the areas I've covered essentially share a common theme. The common theme really is the growing influence and complexity of non-bank financial institutions in financial markets. It also emphasizes the degree of interconnectedness between banks and traditional banks, financial markets and technology platforms, and across borders and exposures. And it really emphasizes the point that this web of exposures can amplify shocks that are difficult to predict, and especially when there's opacity, leverage, and liquidity mismatches. And so really, the whole work that we have done talks about enhancing this resilience by closer risk monitoring, closing the regulatory gaps, and improving the financial plumbing from liquidity safeguards to data transparency. And this is where we believe that policymakers and parliamentarians like yourself have a very important role to ensure that domestic policy frameworks are well informed by international standards that can preserve financial stability in this increasingly non-bank centric world. Let me conclude there. Thank you so much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Mr. Singh. Thank you so much. I'm sure there will be a lot of questions because this subject is so important for us. We parliamentarians are very much preoccupied, I would say, use that term, about how to help raise capital to promote the private sector and to put trust and confidence in the markets and to also attract international investors. Thank you very much. So I will give now the floor to Mr. Norman Loaiza for 7 minutes. I think you have a presentation. And I'm sorry, I will have to insist on respecting the time because at 10:30, Mr. Diop will be coming and we want to, for our parliamentarians to have as much time as possible to have questions for you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Tassi, and thanks to the Global Parliamentarian Forum for this invitation. I believe actually that my presentation is very much complementary to Mr. Singh's presentation because he spoke about the financial market and financial risks. I will talk about the investment climate. And for this purpose, I will use the Business Ready report and project. It's the new report of the World Bank, the one that replaces and hopefully improves upon the report known as Doing Business. There is great need for economic growth. Middle-income economies, where three-quarters of the population in the world live, need about 5% of GDP per capita growth in a sustained manner in order to escape the middle-income trap. That is, in order to become advanced economies. And for low-income economies, such as those in sub-Saharan Africa, the needs for growth are even higher. We have estimated that in order to overcome extreme poverty, these countries need to have at least 9% of per capita GDP growth in the next decade. So these needs of growth contrast with what's happening in case of investment. Investment has actually slowed significantly, especially after the global financial crisis. We can see here that this pattern of a sharp decrease in investment growth has spread all over the world in advanced and also in emerging economies and low-income economies. In this context, then, where are we going to get the growth that is needed for all these development challenges to be overcome? We see that governments have accumulated lots of debt. We see that the threat of inflation is looming. Therefore, monetary and fiscal policies are very constrained. We then argue that it's the role of the private sector then to actually make a significant change. To be sure, the private sector is, in developing economies, an economic giant. It employs already 90% of people. About three quarters of output and investment are produced by the private sector, and it contributes massively to government revenues. The question is that this giant, this economic giant, is like a sleepy giant as well in many countries. It has become stagnant. And the main reason it has become stagnant is that the business environment is not favorable. So what happens when you have lots of barriers in the business environment? The economy is very primitive, it's rudimentary, it's not dynamic. But if these barriers are removed, and instead of these barriers, what we have is actually enablers that facilitate the business environment, then the economy becomes a lot more dynamic, more vibrant, more sophisticated and complex. This is, in fact, what we attempt to do. The question then is, how can we find this business enabling environment? That is the question that we want to address through this report, Business Ready. Business Ready is the new corporate flagship of the World Bank. It was launched, the first edition, in October of last year. We have some reports here, and you can certainly find them online. We started this project with 50 economies last year. This year, in 2025, we will cover about 102 economies, 100 plus economies, and by 2026, we hope to have between 160 and 180 economies, covering most economies around the world. The structure of this project is around the life cycle of the firm. From the moment the firm enters the market, business entry, to the moment that difficult decisions are taken with respect to the solvency of the firm, how to resolve business insolvency. But you can see here all the 10 topics that are covered in this report. The report has, for each of these topics, three pillars. We study the regulatory framework. In fact, Mr. Singh told us how important that is, the rules and regulations that firms must follow as they start a business, as they develop it, and as they close it sometimes. Public services, that is, the facilities that governments can provide in order for firms to comply with regulations, but also the institutions and the infrastructure that enable these firms to develop and grow. And operational efficiency is where we measure whether these regulations and public services are implemented in practice. And what do we learn? From 2024, just 50 economies. So it's a preliminary message. But since we cover economies that represent different income levels and also different geographic regions, we can start getting some sense of what the main message is that we are getting from this report. Despite the great need for economic growth and job creation, most economies are not yet business ready. And if you ask us, well, how ready are we? We can give you an estimate of 60%. Of course, this varies from country to country, but and from topic to topic, but this is a good way of summarizing what we know. 60% is certainly not enough to overcome the challenges that growth might allow countries to do. Then we can highlight what countries have done well. And maybe it's not surprising to learn that advanced economies have better business environments. What is more surprising is something that we have found is that some countries that are not rich have been able to develop a favorable business environment. And let me give you just two examples. One of them is Rwanda. Rwanda has able to double the size of its economy in the last 10 years. it has also been able to attract FDI by 100% in the last 10 years. And we can see this in the performance that they have in the Business Ready report. They are in the top 20% in six out of the 10 topics. Georgia is another example. They have been growing in the last decade by about 5% of per capita GDP. 5% in a sustained manner. And they are in the top 20% in seven out of the 10 topics. But these are just overall measures. We can tell you what countries are doing better. We can tell you about maybe an average of how the world performs regarding business readiness. But the truth is that the wealth of this report, the wealth of the report, is in the number of indicators that it provides for each economy. We have 1,200 indicators, and taken as a whole, they can provide a compass and as a guide for reform for wherever the countries can go. And actually, we can learn about gaps. We can learn about things that are missing. And let me give you an example that comes just from my country. I'm originally from Peru. So we have here are some examples about how Peru does on just three indicators, three of the 1,200, okay? So in order to register a new company, in Peru, it takes 75 days. In the most efficient economy, it's only three. To obtain a construction permit, it takes 180 days. Some economies can do it in one. And the time that firms spend on filing and paying taxes is 480 hours in Peru, and in the most efficient economies, this is only 12 hours. So these gaps, you can see for every country that is assessed in this report. And they can help you, really, to understand where the need is. And moreover, they can tell you how to address the needs by changing, modifying regulations, and also providing better public services. So let me conclude by giving you our request to you. The request that we have, first, is advocate for a better business environment. You can do it through your parliaments. This is absolutely necessary in the context that we're living now. Use this data as a guide for reform. Copy freely, use freely the indicators that we have. They are very rich. We have, of course, the report, which you can access, but we also have a handbook, it's only about 700 pages long, where actually you can get all the ideas for reforms that may be necessary for you.
Thank you. And finally, you have to conclude because
exactly. Thank you.
Won't have much.
And exactly, I want to conclude by asking you to please choose growth whenever you have priorities to make. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. So, Senator Tony Lofredo, with your dual experience as a banker and a parliamentarian, how do you perceive the challenges discussed today for building a private investment environment that is both safe, attractive, and inclusive? You have 5 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Tatsi. Madame, Monsieur, chers amis, chers collègues, bonjour.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for giving me the floor.
Friends, let me begin by thanking the World Bank Group and the IMF and my fellow parliamentarians for convening this timely and essential dialogue. Today's session could not be more relevant. Around the globe, we are grappling with the urgency of unlocking capital for infrastructure, digital transformation, and climate resilience. The message I wish to convey is clear. Private capital flows where it finds clarity, trust, and a supportive policy ecosystem. It's our responsibility as legislators and policymakers to ensure that the ecosystem exists. As a senator and a former banker, I was executive vice chairman at RBC, a senior executive there, and 35 years in the finance industry, so I'm a little biased. I've long believed that private capital, when mobilized responsibly, is one of the greatest engines of economic development and social progress. I've always said wealth is always created by the entrepreneur. But capital is cautious. It doesn't flow into uncertainty. It seeks predictability, opportunity, and trust. And this is where we come in. If we want to unlock transformative investment, especially in emerging markets, we must reinforce the basics, macroeconomic stability, rule of law, transparent regulations, and credible institutions. In Canada, we are fortunate to benefit from one of the strongest and most trusted banking systems in the world, and it helps in attracting private investment. This strength is the cornerstone of our investment climate. Complementing this, government institutions like the Business Development Bank of Canada and the Canada Infrastructure Bank help de-risk projects and bridge market gaps. And let's not forget our pension funds. We've discussed pension funds among the largest and most sophisticated global investors who enhance Canada's reputation as a stable and forward-looking investment destination. Together, these elements make Canada not just a safe place to invest, but a smart place to invest. And I wanted to share my experience and use Canada as a model as to what does work. So what is our role as parliamentarians? We must legislate for investment readiness. That means cutting red tape and simplifying regulatory procedures, ensuring legal clarity and policy consistency, maintaining fiscal predictability and tax transparency. Predictability, so important. And we must encourage smart legislation around ESG, fintech, SME financing. Many of our businesses are small and medium-sized enterprises. And infrastructure development. We should also be embracing digital transformations, technologies like AI and data dashboards. We talked about data. They can improve public procurement, enhance market transparency, automate compliance, and reduce corruption. Digital tools made it easier to build trust and track impact. But we must also remember private capital is not just about profits. It's about purpose. Investments should create decent jobs, support entrepreneurship, and drive inclusive growth, especially for youth, women, and undeserved communities. Here, the World Bank and IMF have critical roles to play, provide guarantees, indicators, and policy expertise, offering technical support on financial sector reform, partnering with us early in the process. And this partnership only works if it's built on coordination, transparency, and decisive action. Let me summarize. Let us also prioritize skill development and human capital investment. Always about people, because when we empower people, we multiply the impact of every dollar of private capital. In closing, let me say this. Private capital follows confidence, and confidence is built on sound policy, strong institutions, and political will. Our task as parliamentarians is to lead with vision, discipline, and trust. Trust is the currency of every relationship. So that capital doesn't just move, but transforms lives, makes the world a better place for all. Thank you.
Thank you, Tony. Thank you very much. And now we move to Giulio Santamaro. Honorable President, the Parliamentary Assembly of the Mediterranean sits at the strategic crossroads of three continents. When you were elected president, in your inaugural speech, you highlighted economic integration, youth employment, and private investment as your top priorities. Can you please share your vision with us?
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Nila. Thanks to all the fellow parliamentarians to be here. It's very important. I would like to underline one data. In the MENA region, startups and SMEs are 96% of the companies, but they only have access to 7% of bank lending. So we have a problem. How do we solve this problem? Mobilizing private capital, for example. And what Tony Lafreda was saying is correct. It's not about just interest, it's about purpose. And I'll give you some examples. For example, in my country, Italy, but these are schemes that are applied in several other countries in Europe, and not only Europe, for example, France, the UK, and so forth. What did we do? First of all, we created long-term investment plans where small savers put their money. There are some tax incentives, and these plans go into funding SMEs in the country. Maybe listed SMEs, but SMEs. And moreover, and this is about parliaments, because it was born thanks to a parliament from a law born in the parliament, so not coming from the government. Well, we created a fund of funds, actually an umbrella fund, where the government, the public sector, put 50% of the money. In particular, in Italy, we are talking about 500 million euros, and the rest is put by privates, incorporating smaller investment funds, investing mostly in SMEs and startups. So, what is the role of the public sector? The role of the public sector is de-risking the investments of other institutional investors, private equity funds, but especially pension funds. Pension funds, they don't like risk. They have a moderate risk appetite framework. And in order to de-risk the investment in SMEs, in real economy, in startups, in our businesses, the government, the public sector, is putting money and is keeping the investment for a 5 years term. So this is just an example. But what can we do? Well, for example, an action, very concrete and very popular action that we can do is improving financial education in our countries, teaching people how to save, even little by little, and how to invest. And this is what we're going to do, for example, in my country, but also within the Parliamentary Assembly of the Mediterranean and in all our parliaments. So, going into more general notes, I would like to highlight the fact that we, in PAM, as PAM, we strongly support the idea of the IMF to create a local government bond market. Talking about debts before I was talking about equity, and that concerning enabling trade within our countries, we started in 2009 to launch the idea of a Mediterranean free trade area, which we will discuss again in Marrakesh, Morocco, your country, Senator Tazi, on the 23rd and 24th May, within the third edition of the Economic Parliamentary Mediterranean Forum. You are all invited if you wish, and I will conclude my intervention thanking you again, and don't give up, because even if sometimes it seems that parliaments cannot do much, government can, this is not completely true. We can do a lot. We have to focus, and we have to be in touch and discuss and take best practices for all our countries. Thank you.
Thank you, Giulio. Thank you very much. So we will now take questions from the audience. I will just kindly ask you three things. If you can introduce yourself, ask a short and quick question, and also be precise about who is the panelist your question is directed to. Thank you. I will take two, three questions. So Nigeria, any other question? Sorry, I can't see the Côte d'Ivoire. Oh, I can't read it from here. Can you see it? No. I have Nigeria, Côte d'Ivoire, and Congo. Okay, so we'll take these three ones. Then we'll move to three other questions. Thank you. So Nigeria?
Yeah, thank you very much. My name is Ibrahim. and I'm a senator from Nigeria. My question got across, actually. My concern really is about data. From where are you talking from?
From where?
From what perspectives are the speaker talking from? Because we don't have data in Africa. You're talking about investment risk. Where is the data? We cannot just access your own platform and be offloading data that are not tangentially rooted into Africa. And I'm worried. So this is a big paper, first-class paper delivered, but I'm worried. Where are the data coming from? Where is the data on investment? How much money outside the banking sector in Africa that we can actually look at in the risk platform? So I will be thinking, maybe rightly or wrongly, that you have to really help us, Ms. Taza from Morocco, about the need for IMF World Bank to jointly, you know, help us to set up Africa Data Bank. It's where we have the data bank that we can make progress. All other things remain projecting things that are not realistic. And we appear finally to be flying from none to unknown investment. And with unknown, the plane can crash. We need data now or never. Africa can never develop without data. And that's it for this. Thank you.
The question from Côte d'Ivoire.
Bonjour. Yes, good morning. Thank you, Leila. I am the Honorable Koulibaly Maghara, Deputy of the National Assembly of Côte d'Ivoire and member of the Administrative Council. My question, I know that I repeat this question often, and I know that this is the preoccupation or the concern of many of you.
I have headphones for translation, so we have to hear the question very perfectly in French, so I can translate it to our panelists in English. Thank you. Excuse-moi si tu peux reprendre ta question.
Could you repeat your question again? Yes, I ask my question to the World Bank, and I will speak in French, Leila, if that's okay. In this world economic context that is more and more uncertain, what are the specific strategies that the World Bank and the IMF recommend to reinforce the economic stability for Africa, in particular in terms of management of economic crises and challenges linked to public debt? Did I speak too fast?
In your room. So please, if we can just remain silent, see if them here,
si
have
pouvez...
the leaders in the room. Thank you.
Merci. So I will repeat my question. Thank you. In this world economic context that is more and more uncertain, what are the strategies, the specific strategies that the World Bank and the IMF recommend to strengthen the economic strength of Africa in terms of managing economic crisis and the challenges, responding to challenges linked to public debt? Thank you.
Merci, Majara. Donc, la troisième question du Congo.
Thank you. The third question is from the Congo. I will express myself in French as well. I would have liked for our presenters to wear their headsets, please.
Et bon, donc, nous avons maintenant des cas. Je vous demande juste 10
secondes. Yes,
temps qu'il y a
please, 10 seconds.
Vous pourrez poser votre question et nous serons la traduction. Merci.
We have interpretation.
C'est bon, vous pouvez poser votre question.
Okay, go ahead, please. My name is Flori Mapamboli. I'm a deputy at the National Assembly at the Democratic Republic of Congo. I have listened to everything that was said on the importance of development and growth, economic growth in the countries, but we share different problems, especially in sub-Saharan Africa. In my country, 42% of our economy is informal, and the remediation rates find themselves at 53%, approximately. we do not have any developed financial markets except the public markets. And this does not enable us to use private capital to develop our economy. So my question is for the World Bank and the IMF, how do these two institutions, how can they help us access the private foreign capital in order to develop our financial, internal financial market? This is my first question. The second question is for Deputy, the Canadian senator, who has shared the experience of his country. How are these reforms, can they be used to migrate from the informal to the formal economy? And also for the reforms at the parliamentary level and increase the intermediation rates between the banks. Thank you.
Answers will be by World Bank and IMF. And for the third and last question, you will have one first question for you, and then the last one is for Tony. So would you like to answer the question about data that has been asked by Nigeria?
Thank you very much. I can quickly try to address the questions that were raised. On data, we are completely in agreement that there is a huge need for data. And you are talking to the right people because we are the heads of the indicators group and we are in close collaboration with the chief statistician of the World Bank, who is also the director of the data group. And she is in charge of Haishen Fu, is her name. She's in charge of the Data 360, a new program of the World Bank that provides new data and also trains statistical offices in different countries so that they can in turn obtain their own information. But in us, you have close partners who can actually help us through that process by providing you data and by also providing training. On the second question of strategies of the World Bank for Africa and for the world, I can summarize it in the following way, that it's all about jobs. It's about job creation, job generation. And this has two sides, the side of the suppliers of labor, that is workers, and this is by skilling and human capital formation. So that is, these are two areas of emphasis now of the World Bank. And the other side is the demand for labor, that is what firms actually want about workers. And here the strategy of the World Bank is about having a larger role of the private sector in generating those jobs. And for that, it is necessary to have regulatory quality, regulatory predictability, as the Senator from Canada emphasized, and the infrastructure and institutions that are needed for the business environment to be sufficiently important. And on the finally, on the question from the gentleman from Congo, I can say the same about private investment, that in order to attract private investment, it is necessary to have not only the strong financial sector in the country, but also have the right conditions so that investment projects are profitable and they attract the investors from abroad. That's what happened, for instance, in the case of Rwanda, where they were so successful in attracting private investment. And the transition of from the informal to the formal economy is necessary all around the world, particularly in countries in Sub-Saharan Africa, Latin America, and South Asia. And the ways to do this is especially by making the formal economy more attractive by streamlining regulations, cutting red tape, for instance, and providing better public services for formal firms so that actually informals can be attracted to that sector as well.
Thank you, Norman. Thank you. Want to add a comment?
Yes. Look, I'll just be very brief in adding on the comments more generally. I think the point that was made regarding the access to private capital, it's a big challenge, clearly, for many countries to be able to have the preconditions in place. But I just, you know, I've just emphasized that having a systematic way in which to develop the financial markets, ensuring that the capital markets are being developed. We heard the senator talked about developing local bond markets, developing, mobilizing savings in a proper manner, creating the domestic demand side is very important to be able to develop your financial markets. And the emphasis that's been consistently placed across the panel on having a regulatory architecture that provides trust and confidence is imperative. I think you heard that comment also yesterday by the World Bank president about the importance of the regulatory certainty. So I think that is an emphasis that is very, very important. As you do that in our work, we continuously see that catalyzing private capital requires the assurance that the frameworks by institutions and regulatory frameworks are very sound and strong. So that is an emphasis I would make as well.
Thank you, Ranji. So now we'll conclude with Tony.
Thank you. Merci pour la question. Je vais vous répondre en anglais pour que.
Thank you for this question. I'm going to speak in English so that most of you can understand me.
When we look at investment, I've always said it's never about us. It's about them. It's about PMR, people. First of all, you have to have the intellectual capacity, the labor, the people that are necessary for the investment to thrive. And when I say people, it's not only the people working there or the people you attract as talent, but also the consumers. And that leads me to the next point. It's markets. And if I can take, no country has ever prospered by isolating themselves economically and geopolitically. You have to have access to markets, to open markets, open trade. In Canada, we are privileged to have 15 free trade agreements with 51 countries covering 1.5 billion people and over 60% of the global GDP. Now, that being said, markets are extremely important. We have in North America consumer-oriented people. The people, the savings rate in Canada before COVID was 3%. So it's about people, markets, and the last thing, not to forget, very important, it's about return. You're in competition. Private investment, wealth is always created by the entrepreneur, not by government, by the entrepreneur. You are in competition, so you have to make it about them. What is the return they will have? How will they have access to the markets? How will they have access to talent they need? Anyway, I'm very passionate about this, and I can go on for a very long time, but I'll keep it there. And if you do have any questions, but remember, PMR, people, markets, return. That return has to be interesting for he who is investing. And the higher the risk, the higher the return. People would say private equity in my time. I did capital markets. I covered every aspect of banking. When I was in capital markets, the private equity return was between 16 and 20%. People would say, "What? Why is private equity want between 16 and 20? Well, the risk is extremely high. I led commercial banking teams for a very long time, majority of my career. And our return was 2%, the margin. Our ROE in commercial banking was 30, 35, but 2%. So every loan I made could have been my last loan. But I didn't get thrown out. I came to the Senate of Canada. I'm very proud. And we can discuss that.
Thank you. Thank you, Tony. Thank you. Thank you, Tony. Thank you to all our panelists for these rich and very inspiring experiences. I'm sure we won't be able to take another round of questions, but we will do that after the presentation of Mr. Mokhtar Diop, the General Manager of IFC. Thank you very much. Thank you. We can applaud our panelists. Thank you.